Welcome to Mysterious Japan, created by Heath Havey and dedicated to the dark histories, ghost stories, and frightful folklore of Japan. These are the stories that give nightmares to the Japanese. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to episode 12 of Mysterious Japan. In this episode, we explore the legendary past of Izu Ooshima, a small island with an area of just 25 square miles. Izu Ooshima is about 70 miles south of Tokyo. Dominating the center of the island is an active volcano called Mihara. It is May 699 Common Era, and Emperor Bunmu sits listening to reports from his imperial command. They are there to tell him of the continuing problems created by a monk named Enno Ozunu, more commonly referred to as Enno Gyoja, which means end the ascetic. Enno Gyoha has established a form of mountain worship called Shugendo. He dwells in the caves of Mount Katsuragi. But Enno Gyoja is no hermit who separates himself from the material world. To the emperor, he is a troublemaker. And even worse, he is some sort of wizard. A man from Korea calling himself Ren Hirotari gives a report. Ren previously trained as a pupil of Enno Gyoja, but in recent years he became jealous of his former master's mystical abilities. Since then, he has been slandering the ascetic monk to the imperial court. Ren tells the emperor,
"Horsi is an evil mystic. He can fly like the Tengu. Demons are his disciples. We think he is immortal. He tried to use demons to build a bridge between Mount Mina and Mount Katsuragi. When two demons resisted him, he subdued them and made them his servants. He uses demons to draw water and gather firewood, and he can instantly immobilize them with spells if they disobey."
Many years since his formation of Shugendo, the now 65-year-old Enno Gyoja still refuses to become a proper Buddhist monk. This is possibly more important to the emperor than rumors of controlling demons. The ascetic refuses all commands from the imperial palace. His sustenance is pine, leaves, and water, and he wears clothes made from wisteria bark. Even worse, his followers are growing in number. The people of Japan primarily live in poverty, and he is teaching them his knowledge of medicinal herbs. She explains control over consciousness and mind, teaching them that enlightenment can be attained by practicing asceticism in the mountains and foregoing traditional Buddhist ways. The emperor's lead advisor believes Ren but sums up their biggest problem, he says. The monk is a menace. Even if we find him in the mountains, he can fly away and evade us. Emperor Bunmu has an idea. We will take his beloved mother captive. He can free her by surrendering himself to us. The imperial forces enact this plan, and it succeeds. Enno Gyoja surrenders himself to free his mother. The emperor initially intends to execute the mystic, but his advisors warn him that execution of such a wizard may invite curses that will plague the reign of the emperor and his offspring. He decides instead to banish him under a charge of sorcery to the island of Izu Ooshima. Since ancient times, Izu Ooshima was used as a penal colony, but no one sent there has ever been as infamous as Enno Gyoja. When Enno Gyoja arrives on the island, even the soldiers there are afraid of him. His fierce, penetrating gaze and dark reputation of controlling demons intimidates even the most hardened warrior. Typical descriptions of Enno Gyoja depict him as a hooded figure having a pointed beard. He holds a staff and wears geta sandals. Many depictions include the demons he controlled standing near him like pets. This is the point where history and legend collide. The people believe he has mastered ancient magic techniques allowing him to obtain supernatural powers. The ancient text of Japanese history states,
"There are so many miracles performed by Enno Gyoja that it would be troublesome to list them all."
The people believed him to consort with demons and fly each night from the penal colony on Izu Ooshima to Mount Fuji to continue growing his powers. One day, the soldiers discover that he is not on the island. The emperor's soldiers find him near the capital and send him back to his exile. They threaten to harm his family should he ever leave the island again. But within a year, Izu Ooshima's volcano, Mount Mihara, explodes. This creates a major fissure on its north side. Natural disasters also begin striking the capital over the next 2 years. These are seen as signs summoned by Enno Gyoja's powers. Then one day, black clouds cover the imperial palace and a voice bellows over the head of the emperor that Enno Gyoja has done nothing wrong and the emperor's punishment is unjust. The voice says it will destroy the world if Enno Gyoja is not set free. And thus it is that Enno Jiosha is just 3 years into his exile when he receives an imperial pardon. He returns to defying the emperor's law by not limiting religious training to monasteries and aristocrats. He teaches to the common people and to anyone who will listen. Through this, he established the Shugendo sect. It is said today that the curses and magic of Enno Gyojo continue to live on the island of Izu Oshima, and that Enno Gyojo turned it into a place of magic and folklore. The legacy of Enno Gyojo lives on in the minds of the Japanese today. His name evokes a type of preternatural dread in some, a mystical and supernatural power in others. In 1991, novelist Koji Suzuki harnesses this mythology and makes Izu Oshima a critical setting in his horror novel Ringu, which was later turned into a 1998 movie in Japan and a Hollywood horror film in 2003 called The Ring. In the book, Enno Gyojo is the source of the curse. Godzilla movies also use the Mahara volcano as a magnetic force that attracts Godzilla and other kaiju to the island. In one of these, Godzilla becomes trapped in rivers of molten lava within the volcano. Part 2. The Birth of the Kappa. Route 208 circles Izu Oshima. Anyone traveling this road can be forgiven for driving past an infamous pond on the western side. No parking, sign, or trailhead provides any indication of its existence. To find the pond, an interested traveler must park at just the right spot, blocking traffic on the two-lane road with hazard lights flashing, and then cross quickly, for there are no sidewalks to walk on or shoulders to park on. No signs point the way. One small and lonely sign on the side of the road tells an abbreviated version of the story behind the cursed pond. The horrific tale begins with two sisters. On an unknown date in the 17th century, Otaki and Kotaki are preteen girls in search of firewood for their small village. They wander further than usual, unable to find any dry wood. Growing tired and thirsty, they stop at a pond. They have never traveled this far before and have never seen this pond, but the water is clear and inviting. Otaki kneels down at the edge of the small pond, cups her hands together, and scoops out a handful of water to drink. Before the water reaches her mouth, a hand bursts from the water and grabs her wrist. The hand is greenish and human-like, small but with long fingers. Both hand and arm are covered in a stringy, sopping wet fur. On Otaki's wrist, the hand feels cold and slimy, but even worse, it has a firm grip. She tries to wrench free, but only manages to topple over. The hand still tightly clenches her forearm. Her sister Kotaki screams and lurches forward to help. It is too late. Whatever is on the other side of that long green arm yanks down, dragging Otaki into the water. She resists, digging her free hand into the mud, and she pushes back, but it is no use. She lets out a scream before being submerged entirely under the water before Kotaki can reach her. Kotaki calls out her sister's name.
Otaki-chan! Otaki-chan!
Scanning the surface of the pond, she sees no trace of Otaki. She starts to scream Otaki's name in terror. Still nothing. In a panic, she moves around the perimeter of the pond but can find no trace of Otaki or the creature that grabbed her. After a few minutes, she loses hope. Without further recourse, she runs back to the village to report the incident. She knows no one will believe her, but there is nothing else to do but tell them. The elder monks listen as Kotaki relates her story. Her panicked voice comes between out of breath, panting after the long run. Tears stream down her eyes. The chief elder narrows his eyes when she describes the arm of the creature.
What you describe is a kappa. They seek to kill young girls and livestock and protect their water. They can even possess the bodies of young people like a demon. Just as you say, they are known to drag people into the water and drown them, especially if anyone tries to drink from the water. They are a water kami and should not be treated lightly. I am afraid your sister is dead.
Another elder speaks up with a solemn bow, speaking to the chief.
The kappa devour people alive and drink their blood. They have been known to rape fertile women to produce offspring if they dare swim their rivers or ponds.
The chief nods slowly. Yet a third elder adds his own understanding, stating that the kappa are malevolent creatures that direct their anger at humans and livestock, and as supernatural creatures, they can speak the human tongue. With three elders confirming and adding to the lore, they debate on a course of action. The chief says,
"If a Kappa has invaded our waters, then I don't think Ataki will be the only casualty."
Agreeing with this assessment and deferring to the chief, they decide they must capture the Kappa for the sake of the villagers. Turning to Kotaki, they tell her to lead them to the pond. The elders carry only staffs in their faith as weapons. Kotaki takes them to the pond, but there is no sign of the Kappa or of Otaki. The elders space themselves around the perimeter of the pond, sit in the lotus position, and begin chanting. Their prayers continue until nightfall. A full moon rises, and they continue to chant. When the moon is almost directly overhead, the water begins to ripple near the center of the pond. The monks watch closely but continue chanting their mantra. Another ripple, this time nearer the edge. Bubbles rise to the surface. Standing behind the group, Kotaki gasps and takes an instinctive step back. The monks raise the volume of their chanting to appeal to the gods. They fall back in astonishment when the creature erupts from the water. This is like no natural creature they have ever seen. Water drips from its body and its skin glistens under the light of the full moon. Its skin consists of mottled yellow and green scales textured like a reptile. Its eyes gleam yellow with black slits seeming to glow in the night. Hair covers most of its body, including its head, all except a rounded, bald spot on the top like a monk's tonsure where the cap of the head is a depression like a baby's fontanelle. Its jaw and mouth protrude like a monkey. It snarls at them, bearing pointed teeth. The creature stands no taller than a child, half the size of a man. It turns its head from side to side, scanning the monks who stare at it in disbelief. This is the legendary Kappa. In shock, the monks jump to their feet with staffs held in defensive postures. Even more shocking, the Kappa speaks their language, its voice sounding like a disconcerting hiss and rattle as it says, "If any seek to drink this water, I will punish the villagers." The monks stand paralyzed in fear. It tells them, "Do you understand? I will kill them." Without waiting for a response, the creature dives into the water, leaving the monks alone once more. They wait all night, ready to challenge the creature again. It does not appear again. Disappointed, they return to the village. The chief passes an edict forbidding anyone from going to the pond or drinking from its accursed water. They begin calling it the Kappa water. From that time forward, this warning and prohibition are passed from one generation to the next. No matter how much they need water, they do not take water from that pond. The prohibition continues to this day. The pond is overgrown with wild flora, untouched by the people of Izu Ooshima. But what really happened? Was it really a legendary Kappa? Those who don't believe the tale have their own theories. Some theorize that Otaki drowned in the pond and that Kotaki saw something like a frog, monkey, or salamander. Indeed, signs on the road warn passers-by to watch out for Japanese frogs, but such frogs are small and do not make good candidates for the Kappa presented in this legend. The monkey theory postulates that the sisters saw a Japanese macaque monkey. These would have been about the right size and have matted fur. They are also found in the mainland in the nearby Izu area, so it is conceivable that some found their way to the island, as they do exist on other islands in Japan. They communicate with kus and a gurnet call when aggressive, which could have been mistaken for language, and they bathe in ponds. The salamander theory claims that the Kappa may have been the giant Japanese salamander called the Hanzaki. Its skin tone closely matches that reported for the Kappa, and it can grow up to 5 feet in length. A remarkable feature that matches this Kappa story is that the salamander is known to grab prey with its strong jaws and drag them into water, and it frequents the rivers, lakes, and ponds traditionally associated with the Kappa. But though this may be the source of some Kappa tales, it is unlikely to be associated with this tale, as there are no known cases of the Hanzaki on Izu Ooshima. The most gruesome theory of all is based on true incidents. When struggling in times of famine or poverty, primarily during the period from 1603 to 1867, some families felt no choice but to sacrifice their young or newborn babies. Throwing them into a pond or river was a common way to dispose of them. They call these sacrificed children leech babies. This name derives from the description of the bloated corpses found in the water. The corpses have shrunken green skin, covered with worn and matted hair. The bodies bloat with gas. The appearance gives the image of the Kappa. Many believe that Kappa folklores arose from these ghastly discoveries, but these are not known to have happened on Izu Ushima and cannot be the source of the legend here. These discrepancies in the various theories make the Kappa in this tale hard to debunk. Of course, there are many who believe the Kappa are real. Shinto temples throughout Japan, from Tokyo to Kyushu, have glass cases with severed Kappa hands on display. Regardless of the veracity or source of the legend, tales of the Kappa have been used for centuries in Japan as a cautionary tale to keep children away from ponds, rivers, or other bodies of water that might be dangerous. Parents typically portrayed the Kappa like a bogeyman for children to fear if they do not obey. They are the evil that will drag down children who disrespect parental authority. Part 3. The Tale of the Kainan Hoshi. When the Tokugawa Shogunate unified Japan in 1603, many political dissidents were exiled to Izu Ushima, along with criminals and other outcasts. The year is 1627, and Japan still reels in political upheaval. The outcasts at Izu Ushima still may not leave the island. Many are second generation and have never seen the mainland at all, yet they are still treated like criminals. Overseeing these exiles is a deputy officer called a daikan. His name is Toyoshima. He is the de facto ruler of Izu Ushima and its six sister islands. The shogunate gives him little oversight since they are so far from the mainland, and he has free rein to do as he chooses without repercussion. The dictator in him surfaces, and he becomes more cruel with each passing year. Toyoshima was born into a renowned samurai clan, respected for over 600 years. To his elitist mindset, these islanders and outcasts are beneath him, and he treats them like second-class citizens worse than livestock. He orders all islanders to receive a tattoo marking them as criminals. Children are not exempt. To Toyoshima, being born a peasant on the islands is crime enough. He subjugates them by ruthlessly collecting tributes and taxes. Any complaint is met without mercy and with the harshest of punishments. Even small trespasses are punished with violence or confiscation of property. Each year, he squeezes them for more. The islanders universally revile him, but they can say nothing. He treats his retinue of retainers well and pays them out of exorbitant tributes. As retainers, they have nothing to do but train for fights, drink sake, and partake of the women provided to them by Toyoshima from the daughters of the islanders. They are nearly as cruel as their leader. Unarmed and without military training, the islanders are farmers and fishermen who are helpless to do anything against Toyoshima and his retainers. Among the islanders at Izu Ushima is a 20-year-old young man whose name has been lost to time, but we will call him Daizo. Growing up, Daizo has seen his family stripped of property. Their food and salt has been taken. Anything of value can be taken by Toyoshima, and he takes it all. Every year, Toyoshima raises their taxes. And now, on most nights, they go to bed hungry. On the mainland, taxes are typically paid in rice, but here on the island, taxes are paid in salt. In 1627, the islanders face forest fires, leaving them without salt to pay. They do not even have sufficient water. But Toyoshima is not moved by their plight. If they cannot provide the required salt, he will confiscate their food. He takes their potatoes, which is all they have to get them through the winter until the spring of 1628. Even this is not enough for Toyoshima. He demands as a further tribute that young women be brought to him as concubines and to service his retainers. Toyoshima lines up the girls from the village. Among those chosen is Daizo's sister. This is too much to bear. Daizo erupts in a rage, calling Toyoshima a tyrant. Toyoshima orders his retainers to take Daizo. He immediately sentences Daizo to be flogged, which is called tataki in Japanese. Though flogging has been discontinued since the end of the Warring States period 25 years ago, Toyoshima continues the tradition. He knows he will not be reprimanded. His goal is to keep the islanders in a state of fear and obsequious obedience. With hands bound in front of him, Daizo is led to the public square. The law allows no more than 100 lashes for the most serious of crimes. Normal flogging is only 10 to 50 lashes, and 60 to 100 lashes are reserved for crimes of arson, theft, rape or murder, and, of course, treason. Toyoshima decides that Daizo's comments are sedition, warranting the most severe penalty short of execution. Toshima takes the girls and leaves. He finds no need to be here. His retainers tie Daizo's hands around a tree. They strip him naked. No words are spoken. 50 lashes slice open Daizo's back. The pain draws tears from his eyes and his body shakes and trembles. During the lashing, he falls to his knees, but one of the retainers lifts him back up. He is only halfway done. The remaining 50 lashes are administered to his buttocks. By the end, Daizo is dizzy. His eyes water, and he can see blood-stained sand soaking the dirt around the tree. For a month, he is in too much pain to leave his bed. During that month, his family's last possessions are confiscated. This is what happens to possessions of the family of a traitor. Toyoshima threatens them with hard labor if they resist. Taizo's mother stands up to protest, but the nearest retainer draws his sword. He says, "If you resist, I will take your ear." Cutting off an ear or nose is a common punishment, especially under Toyoshima's draconian and sadistic reign. His mother kneels prostrate to show obeisance. Without rising, she lets the tears fall freely to the ground. Once the retainers are gone, Daizo's father chastises Daizo for his loose tongue, which has ruined his family and put them in a state of desperation and poverty. He tells Daizo without sympathy,
"Be glad. You are not a slave, or he would have given you 200 lashes. You may not have survived that. You endanger us all. Where's your familial honor? You think only of yourself."
Daizo wants to protest. He wants to say that he spoke out to help them all. He knows the stories of rebellions on the mainland, where peasants rose up in revolt against daimyo who overtaxed them and treated them with cruelty. But Daizo holds his tongue. His father would not understand. His father has not been stuck here his whole life. His father was exiled to Izu Oshima with his mother after the siege of Osaka in 1615. Daizo was a child then. He barely remembers it. His father held his tongue back then because he felt his punishment was just. But Daizo has done nothing wrong then and now only protests tyranny. To Daizo, the young adults of the island are being punished for the wrongs of their parents. They begin to talk in secret, planning a coup as the new year approaches. Even this talk, they know, is punishable by death. And Toyoshima's preferred method of execution is crucifixion in the sea, with hands and legs splayed in the form of an X. The waters rise and fall for days until the punishment results in death by exhaustion, thirst, or drowning, and then the body is left as a warning for any others considering insurrection. Daizo meets the other young men in secret at night. 25 young men kneel on the dirt near the temple. They all share Daizo's zeal for ending Toyoshima's reign. They all agree that nothing short of his death will suffice. But when and how? Having grown up on the island, they know how to gauge which days bring the most violent storms and roughest waters. They only had to wait for the right weather to make itself known. That night comes on January 24, 1628. The storm rages and the sea throws up choppy and irregular waves that crash against themselves. A small boat cannot survive in these waters. During the day, the 25 young men decide to warn the village, going from house to house telling each family to stay in their houses and avoid looking at the sea that night. They warn the villagers, telling them, "Make no sounds. Anyone caught this night will surely be executed." After nightfall, the young men approach Toyoshima's compound. A stealthy approach is not necessary. The loud noises of the carousing Toyoshima and his retainers carry across the compound. The sentries have never experienced trouble. There have never been any rebellions, and so they all have their guards down. The 25 young men find Toyoshima in his room with one of the girls he had taken from the village. They pounce. Their attack comes as a complete surprise. Toyoshima has no chance to resist or raise an alarm. From all around, fists beat him and feet kick him. They show him no mercy as they hit and kick, just as he has shown no mercy to them or their families. While Toyoshima moans, the young men drag him out of the house into the dock. They beat him the whole way until he finally falls unconscious. His face is sheathed in blood and his breathing becomes faint. His retainers, drinking sake and laughing raucously, suspect nothing. The 25 young men drag Toyoshima across the dock to the red sailboat he uses to go around the island. They heft him onto the boat and push it into the violent waves of the storm-tossed sea. Rain falls around them, but they stand there and watch silently as the sailboat heaves left and then lurches right. The waves lift and drop it as the sail takes the boat farther away from them. It does not take long. A swell from the violent sea lifts the sailboat, which lists deeply to the right and then capsizes. The young men watch from the dock as the boat sinks into the raging sea. Then they gasp with shock. A hand suddenly reaches out of the water. It grasps at the air. Toyoshima breaches the surface of the water for a moment, but the sea then swallows him forever. Cries of alarm ring out. The retainers have noticed Toyoshima's absence and are searching for him in the compound. Perhaps the young girl he was with has warned them. The 25 young men run from the docks, but they are too late. The retainers are yelling and pointing at the water. They see the red sails of the boat sinking below the water. They also see the young men fleeing down the road to the east toward the village. They can surmise what has happened. With the retainers giving chase, the young men escape into the village seeking refuge. They go door to door, just as they did earlier in the day. They bang on the threshold of each house and ask for refuge. They plead to be let in. The yells of the retainers make the villagers realize what the young men have done. They fear retribution and refuse to give aid. No one will give the young men a hiding place. They will not even lend them a boat. Even Daizo's own family refuses to harbor or help the fugitives. As the retainers begin to search the houses, the young men flee past the village down the coast on the northeastern side of the island. They arrive at a Shinto shrine called Hajikama. They are lucky. The retainers are focused on searching the village and have not seen them flee. In a panic, they discuss their options while hiding at the shrine. In time, Toyoshima's retainers will make sure that the villagers disclose all their names. They will be too afraid to withhold any information. Word may even reach the shogun. Remaining anonymous is not an option. Daiso tells them, "We have only one option. We have to leave the island." They all concur, but they know they cannot take boats from the villagers. Not only will the villagers suffer the wrath of the retainers, but the retainers will also be watching the boats and docks for just such an escape. A unique aspect of this shrine is that it is surrounded by cedar trees. The young men pick the largest, take tools from the shrine, and begin sawing. These cedar trees are considered holy, and the young men consider themselves on a righteous mission to defeat evil. From a holy cedar tree, they carve dugout canoes to escape. The shrine is located at the edge of the sea, allowing for a stealthy escape. After working together all night, they have carved out their boats by dawn. The waves are still choppy from the bad weather, but these young men are skilled boatsmen. They row across the way to the three sister islands of Toshima, Niejima, and Kozushima. Toshima is a tiny island with but one place of entry. When the islanders there hear why the young men have come in their makeshift canoes, they turn them away. The villagers may despise Toyoshima, but they are afraid of being punished. At the slightly larger island of Niejima, the young men find themselves similarly shut out by the islanders there. Kozushima is no more friendly, and the town magistrate turns them away, refusing shelter. Despondent, the 25 young men turn from the islands. They have no option except to return to Izu Ooshima. These canoes will never make it all the way to the mainland. Their canoes are not holding up well in the water. As they approach their home village, the violent waters swell again. The storm has returned. The villagers see the canoes approaching in the storm. They see the canoes sink as the swelling waters pull them down. The canoes never make it. All 25 young men are killed. Daizo would never see his sister again, and the villagers would live with the guilt that they let their sons die at sea. This is where history crosses into folklore. After the death of these young men, the villagers feel that a curse has come upon them and the island. It is fueled by the vengeful wrath of the young men they let die. Beginning January 24 of each year to the morning of January 26. The spirits of these dead men cross the sea looking for revenge on the cowardly islanders. On Izu Ooshima, these 25 spirits are known as Himi-sama. It is said that the spirits of the 25 young men appear off the coast of the town beginning in the middle of the night on January 24. They float in dugout canoes and carry colored flags. They are looking for vengeance against the family and friends who abandoned them to die. The 25 young men are now a type of Japanese spirit called an onryo. An onryo is a type of ghost resulting from a person dying an untimely death and holding a grudge. These grudge spirits can cause physical harm or calamities in the world of the living to redress the wrongs caused to them. As penance, every year on January 24, islanders place 25 pebbles from the shore to make a path to their front door. They prepare 25 mochi cakes and line them in a row outside their door as a talisman. They lock their doors and close the shutters. Some will wedge tobera leaves in the cracks of their shutters and doors to prevent any crack from showing. Others cover their windows with newspapers to prevent looking out at the sea. They remain in their houses all day and all night, refraining from any loud noises or anything that might attract the attention of the ghost seeking vengeance. They are not supposed to look at the sea. No one works on this day, and many will fast during this time without ingesting a morsel of food. Prior to indoor plumbing, they would take care of bodily functions in a pot in the house rather than risk leaving. This is a practice passed on generation to generation. They believe the curse continues from generation to generation. Each year, family is appointed to receive the Himi Sama spirits as guests. They send one family member to spend the night on the beach and welcome the spirits if they appear. Their goal is then to lead them safely to and from the island to ensure no mishap befalls them. Under the curse of the Himi Sama, those who fail to follow these procedures are said to meet with disaster. They may lose the ability to speak, or they may contract psychological illnesses requiring hospitalization. And those who venture outside may find themselves face to face with the Himi Sama spirits. Seeing the vengeful spirits is thought to drive them mad and blind them. They return home covered in blood, unable to speak or see. Some are found dead the next day with their faces twisted in horror, and still others disappear and are never heard from again. In one case, after three men drink at the beach all night and ignore the curse, they collapse upon returning home the next day. They begin to mutter Kainan Hoshi just before dying at the threshold of their homes.
Kainan Hoshi! Kainan Hoshi! Ukina Hoshi!
The Himi Sama spirits belong to a class of ghostly manifestations in Japan known locally as the Kainan Hoshi. This literally translates as shipwrecked priests, but to the islanders. They classify these spirits in this manner out of respect for the bravery of these young men, their use of the holy cedar tree, and as a symbol of contrition. At Hajikama Shrine, the spirits of the 25 young men are enshrined each year next to the stump of the cedar tree they cut down. The stump remains as a testament to their desperate act to escape certain execution. To many, Hajikama Shrine is considered the most active supernatural location on the island. But the Himi Sama spirits are not the only curse that returns each January 24. The vengeful spirit of the evil Toyoshima also returns. He is said to travel around the Izu Islands on this day in his red sailboat. His goal is to sink any boats he comes across. Another belief is that he appears as a giant spirit seeking to topple and capsize the boats that dare to enter his waters on this day. This 100-foot-tall giant rises from the sea to smash and capsize boats crossing into his territory. As in life, his wrathful spirit shows no mercy in death, and any boat reckless enough to be at sea that day may find itself the target of his rage. As ominous as these legends and ancient tales may be, they pale in comparison to the dark and tragic history of what happened at Mihara, the volcano at the center of Izu Oshima. We examine this violent history in the next episode of Mysterious Japan.
This has been Mysterious Japan, created, written, and translated by Heath Havey. Thank you for listening and making this podcast possible. Please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Please join us next time as we continue to explore the dark histories and strange mysteries of Japan.